Gentlemen, on May 24th, three Turkmen soldiers were shot dead in a cross-border infiltration by the Afghan-based militants to Turkmen territory. This was the second such incident in less than 3 months. There is no concrete information about who were the attackers in this specific incident. But in recent days and months, we hear talks about increasing activities of non-local militants in northern Afghanistan, which, according to numerous Afghan officials, includes militants from Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. A parliamentarian from Faryab province has just told us that militants belonging to IMU are present in several districts in northern Afghanistan. So does it mean that after hiding from some years in tribal region of Pakistan, the group is again on the rise? What are their connections with other radical-minded people in Central Asia? What are the truth behind their increasing activities in northern Afghanistan, and how to see their current and potential threat to Central Asia in the future when most of the foreign troops are gone from Afghanistan by 2014? So this is the subject we aim to discuss today. With me here, I have Alisher Siddiqov, who is director of Uzbekistan service at RFRL, and I would say he is one of the most informed person about IMU. And then next to me, I also have Bruce Panier, who has in fact surprised me yesterday, saying that he had a chance even to see some of the family members of the top leaders of the IMU in its initial days of formation. Bruce, thank you for being here. I have on the phone Jacob Zen, Eurasia analyst for Jamestown Foundation, who is currently in Urumqi, China. Noah Toker is on the line from Washington, D.C. He is managing editor at Uzbekistan.net. And then we have Haji Said Dawood, director of Afghan Media Resources Center in Kabul, who is joining us to talk from the Afghan perspective of the matter. And we have Alexei Malashenko, Central Asia analyst at Carnegie Center in Moscow, and who is going to give us some perspective from the Russian aspect on this matter. So thank you, colleagues, for sparing your time for this discussion, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thanks. Since I begin my opening with the fatalities in the Afghan-Turkmen border, to get rolling the discussion, why not to start with you, Mr. Dawood? Please educate us, what is the role of IMU or any other Central Asian militant groups behind recent wave of tension in northern Afghanistan?
In the beginning of 1996, 97, 98, resistance parties of Uzbekistan and Tajikistan in Central Asia, they are not more involved with the Afghan internal fighting. And later, in 1999, they also support one of another parties. When national troops led by United States, they came to Afghanistan, and, you know, they pull out all these Taliban from Afghanistan and their alliance, and even to Waziristan. In these, all resistance parties, they reorganize against in Waziristan and Mumbai Agency, Khabar Agency, close to the Chatral, in these area, in all these border area, which is they can pass and jump from Chatral to Kunar, Nuristan, Badakhshan, go to Tajikistan, and same things. They went to Faryab, Saripul, Jawzjan, in these area. And I think they have included Takhar and Baghlan and Kunduz, the northern area of Afghanistan. And I think when United States was physically here with NATO forces, their activity was, you know, smooth, and they are not so active. And since 2012-13 and this year, they are more active in the northern part of Afghanistan, like you mentioning. These, they have aligned right now with the Afghan resistance parties. And I think one of the reasons why they kill, there is many rumors. Some of these people, they thinking there was one of the Taliban faction led by Motasim Aghajan, which he came from Dubai. And he was in Dubai for a few days. There was a lot of, you know, stories. He arrested, or he is somewhere there. Finally, he came to Kabul. And there were rumors in Kabul. Maybe Motasim Aghajan can set a peace process from Turkmenistan, and he can go there. It may be one of the reasons, maybe some of these resistance parties from, like you mentioning, IMU or another parties, because they have a lot of parties, they can kill these three soldiers.
Right.
And I think just this is still, we heard there in Faria province, that is like Waziristan. In all Central Asia, resistance parties, they are there, they are so active. In daily basis, we have a lot of reports that even if they are fighting with the Afghan troops, in same time, they are preparing for 2016 or 14 or 15, and they are follow up the situation. Maybe when the U.S. troops is withdraw from Afghanistan, they can make more action.
Thank you, Mr. Dawood. Colleagues, just to remind you that, you know, please interrupt each other whenever there's a need for it. Give questions to each other. So I just want to have a kind of informal discussion here. So next to me is Alisher Siddiqov. Alisher, you had you contacted with IMU people through your channel to understand its presence in northern Afghanistan, as just Mr. Dawood was talking about. From their point of view, what was that you have learned from your discussion with them?
So I think we're pretty much in a good situation here because we understand Uzbek, and pretty much of the information that is being released by IMU, it's all in Uzbek. So they don't take efforts to translate it to other language. So that's why we kind of follow the website. I don't know whether I'm allowed to announce the site, but in any case, for many security services, this is a good source of information to follow up the latest movements and the point of view, the opinion. So I'm looking to at the latest reports, and all of them is coming from Afghanistan. It's regarding the operation in Afghanistan. Here they claim that they killed a high-level officer of Afghan army, the latest. It is on 17th of May, 15th of May, another Afghan operation. They say they had a fighting for 4 hours. So this is the daily kind of operations. And just looking at the latest reports, it seems like since recently they've pretty much becoming active in the northern Afghanistan. I'm just looking to it from the media perspective. The other thing is that looking at every year, IMU is releasing the list of those who were killed, so-called became martyrs of IMU. And that is another pretty interesting analysis you can get from there, because majority of people who are being killed, and they are Uzbeks of Afghan origin. So it is Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. It doesn't look like very much belongs to Uzbekistan, or the aim, the target, the purpose, the final target is no longer Uzbekistan as such. Though when we challenge them, you know, because we have contacts with them, we talk to them, we challenge them. I mean, what is your purpose now? Where are you now? What are you standing for? So, and the answer is kind of a totally unexpected, surprising for many people in Uzbekistan to understand, because the answer is clear. We are fighting an infidel army of Pakistan. And that's it, you know, that is the whole agenda on the table. Fighting infidel army of Pakistan, fighting infidel army of Afghanistan. But where is Uzbekistan in this stance? So from these statements, my personal conclusions were that they are now more like hired militants by some other local groups. Because those groups that shelter them, they also give them the task which they are doing. And the members are brainwashed in this way so that they are fighting this someone's war in a way. You know, from Uzbekistan's perspective, these guys are totally fighting someone else's fight in totally other country and in totally Someone might guess, you know, someone might even welcome if they would fight regime in Uzbekistan. You know, that was the original purpose of Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, to bring caliphate to the whole Central Asia, to Eastern Turkestan. But now what we see, they're pretty much in clash with the local kind of with the local agenda. So what do you think, Bruce? I mean, do you have the same feeling of?
I also just want to add here the killing of the six Turkmen soldiers in 3 months. Although we don't have any confirmation who are basically behind those things, but again, it looks like that there is something going on in the border too. I mean, whether IMU is part of that or not, but.
Yeah, and I totally agree with our colleague that in a way there is a sense that after U.S. withdrawal, that will embolden them. Surely the decision is kind of a decision by the United States, but the understanding and the propaganda that they're spreading among each other, spreading out to the world, is that we driven Americans out. They came here, they could not annihilate us, they were not able to do anything with us. So my opinion, that will possibly will even increase their ranks.
Bruce, especially keeping in mind that six Turkmen soldiers are killed in 3 months. So where do you see this trend is going in the north?
Okay, and I'll keep this as brief as possible because I know we've got other guests. I want to hear what some of our other guests have to say too. The IMU is certainly not the same group that it was in 1999. It's much more diffuse is the word I'll use. It's splintered a bunch. We got to remember that they've gone through at least four leaders since 1999 when they showed up in southern Kyrgyzstan. So there's certainly, based on what we hear from Afghanistan and places like the Wardaj district in Badakhshan or closer to the Turkmen border in places in Faryab and Baghdiz, places like that, that the Afghans believe that they are active and that this is the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, who's sometimes mingling with the Taliban, sometimes moving on their own. The Central Asian governments continue to arrest people that they say are the IMU. So while we might discount the majority of the arrests and imprisonments in Central Asia, there might be some small percentage that actually are IMU. And I'll point most recently to prior to the Tajik presidential election, they arrested a group of people last year who they said were plotting to destabilize the situation ahead of elections. So the IMU does seem to be present. I would just make the point that it's not the core group that it once was, and it seems to be the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan seems to have taken on a brand name, much like Al-Qaeda now. And it's hard to say if everyone who claims to be from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan is actually from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan or just feels that this is a way to attract people to whatever group that they really do represent. And we've had any number of misidentifications. In Tajikistan, for instance, they think that this Jamiat Ansarullah group is also, they've been identified as actually called the Islamic movement of Tajikistan. You know, Jamiat Ansarullah has responded and denied that they have any connection. What is certain is that there's a group, what everyone will agree on is that there's groups of ethnic Uzbeks. They've teamed up with a lot of other peoples from Central Asia, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, and they do seem to be running armed illegal operations. Often they do attack government forces in northern Afghanistan. So there's certainly a presence there. As far as it being a coherent group, I couldn't say that they do seem to be under one leader at this moment. And the Islamic Jihad Union is a classic example of a splinter group which no longer seems to pay attention to what the people claiming to be the head of the IMU are ordering right now. And what the IMU is doing in Pakistan is not clear it's coordinated with what's going on in Afghanistan right now. To some extent, yes. To some extent, no. So that's I'll just set the table there, and hopefully our guests will fill in some of the details.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. Whether it's one group or several groups operating under the same name, but in Moscow, I think Kremlin has its own concerns about that. Alexei Malashenko, In the last discussion on potential threat of the Taliban to Central Asia after 2014, last week actually, we had Artum Ulanyan from Academy of Science in Moscow in the program. I remember him saying that Kremlin is not much afraid of the Taliban, but according to Kremlin, the potential threat is coming from within Central Asia. What kind of threat Moscow is feeling there?
Well, it seems that in Moscow, first of all, in Kremlin, they understand that Taliban is a movement in Afghanistan, doesn't present a big threat for Russia, right, of course. But however, it seems that Putin and his team, and particularly military men, they would like to exaggerate Taliban's threat. Why? Because it is a pretext to keep Russian political presence and military presence in the region. By the way, the organization of the Collective Security Treaty was created under pretext of certain foreign threat. What kind of threat could it be? Mm-hmm. From what it can come? Only from Afghanistan. That's why in Russian foreign policy in Central Asia, I think the factor of Talibs plays a big role. But anyway, I don't believe that Talibs or their lines in Central Asia represent a threat for Russia. Meanwhile, there is another problem for Moscow, for Russian Federation. This is a migration from Central Asia, Muslim migration. At the moment, we have in Russian Federation, within Russian Federation, something about 4 million Muslims came, who continue to come to arrive from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, plus from Azerbaijan. And they bring with them some ideas, some Islamic radical ideas. So this is indeed, it becomes a real problem, because at the moment we can see, we have to recognize the existence of radical Islamic circles in Russia everywhere. And these circles, this group, are composed with Russian Muslim citizens, Tatars or Caucasians, and at the same time with Tajik and Uzbeks. Indeed, it's a problem, because before it's never has been existed, yes? And so we can say that Islam from Central Asia is an additional factor of radicalization of Islam in Russia. Yeah? From that point of view, if let's imagine that withdrawal from Afghanistan will lead to a certain destabilization in Fergana Valley, well, this factor indeed could impact on the general situation on Muslims in Eurasia and in Russian part of the Eurasia. This is a real problem.
Jacobson, you have been doing quite a bit work on IMU in Central Asia and its potential connections with local radical groups or militants. Who are the local militants, Jacob, we are talking about here, and what kind of potential collaboration they might have?
I think that the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, just like some other Central Asian militant groups like the Turkestan Islamic Party or previous Kazakh ones that emerged in 2011 called Jund al-Khilafah, mostly these are Central Asians that mix together in Pakistan as well as parts of Afghanistan, and then they use their names like Islamic movement of Uzbekistan as a brand for propaganda purposes to recruit through the internet or through the jihadist videos on online forums, or to claim attacks in the media. But on the ground, I think there's very little importance given to whether you're in the IMU or the Turkestan Islamic Party, or you carry out an attack with the Pakistani Taliban. None of these militants have, you know, ID cards that formalize themselves in a militant group, and they might shift from training with the IMU to the Taliban to Al-Qaeda even. And it's common when, for example, Uyghur militants are killed in Pakistan that you find that a number of Taliban militants were also killed with them. So they're really mixing together. And in the post-2014 world, one of the possibilities is that these groups will all collaborate together towards achieving each other's aims. So recently we've seen an increase in violence in Xinjiang province in China. And the types of attacks that are being carried out are not the types that people with local grievances just carry out. When we talk about suicide bombings or car bombings, these are attacks that are usually signs of the influence of groups that are close to Al-Qaeda or that share the Al-Qaeda ideology. So what I mean to say here is that the IMU may be providing training grounds towards, you know, Uyghur militants who then connect with people at home or who return to Xinjiang and then carry out these types of attacks.
I would like to give microphone to Noah in Washington, D.C., Noah Trucker. In recent months, Noah, we have seen a number of people from Central Asia in Syria apparently fighting together with the government opponents there. What does it say about the potential of radicalism in Central Asia and their scope to do some harm in the future?
Well, I don't know that it says a whole lot about what's going to come back to Central Asia. I think one of the things that I agree with a lot of the things that my colleagues have said, especially Alashir and Bruce, about the way that the IMU especially has become very diffuse, and that they seem to exist almost as kind of two different groups, one in Pakistan and one in Afghanistan. And I really agree with Alashir's point that if we want to find out what they're doing and what they care about, it helps just to listen to them and read their websites and listen to their media and things like that. And I absolutely agree that they're very clear in their public statements that for them, the primary conflict is the one in Pakistan. But one of the other things that we see happening is that a lot of the attention, not just in, in online forums and on social media and among, I think, recruiters and sympathizers as well, has now shifted to Syria rather than in Pakistan. Pakistan is kind of yesterday's war. And the IMU are losing, the IMU have admitted themselves in some of their statements that they're losing some of their members to Syria as well. So the whole focus of public attention and even of some of their own members has shifted to Syria, and that's draining them. And that's another one of the reasons why, you know, for all of the good reasons that we've listed so far, that they may not actually be a serious threat to security and stability in Central Asia over the next couple of years. This is another one, that they're losing members and they're losing recruits to Syria instead. And in terms of whether or not the recruits and current militants who go to fight to Syria will ever become a threat to return to Central Asia, that's something that they talk about more and more. I mean, the Uzbeks who are in Syria in the last couple of months, in particular, have started to talk about returning to Uzbekistan in different ways to return home. You know, they frame it as a larger aspiration that they'll fight in Syria first and then take the fight back home and overthrow Karimov and this sort of thing. But I mean, it's entirely aspirational, and the average lifespan for a lot of these commanders, even the ones who are charismatic and who are able to form their own groups and acquire even a good reputation among the other militants fighting in Syria, the average lifespan for them is about 6 months, and it's a very brutal conflict, and it shows no signs of ending anytime soon. So, I mean, this is certainly a big shift. I think it's the biggest shift that we've had since the IMU was driven in Pakistan in 2001 in terms of the Uzbek jihadi community as such as one exists. But I don't think that it's going to have any near-term consequences for people inside Central Asia.
And Noah, you seem to be downplaying threat of militants to Central Asia. Then my question is, who are those people who are going to Syria? Then how their recruiting channels are being conducted, I believe, in the region?
A very large proportion of the population of young male Central Asians doesn't live in Central Asia. They live as migrant workers in Russia, in Turkey, in Europe, and other places. And it's much easier for them to travel into Syria. In fact, it's much easier for them to travel to Syria than it is for them to travel to Pakistan. And this is one of the things that the IMU has talked about in their public statements. In the fall, they released a statement where they admitted this, that it's not only easier to get to Syria, but it's cheaper to get to Syria, and they were having a hard time competing for recruits. So it's actually very easy for an Uzbek migrant laborer or a Tajik migrant laborer who's in Moscow to travel across the land border to Turkey and travel across another land border into Syria, and there's not a whole lot of sort of official opposition to this. Turkish officials are more or less letting this process go on, and Russian officials are as well. I think as far as they're concerned, it's sort of exporting a problem.
Thank you, Noah. Bruce, I think you have a point to say on this subject.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up one thing real quick, and I kind of agree that in the near-term future, the militants, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan or whichever militant groups are present in northern Afghanistan probably don't present an immediate threat to Central Asian security. One of our speakers in a previous talk had mentioned that it's actually even in the Taliban's interest that they do not present a huge threat to Central Asia until the Taliban has more area under their control because they don't need more enemies. However, a little bit longer term, the governments in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and actually Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan a little bit further away have shown historically that they're absolutely hostile to the Taliban. So it will be useful for the Taliban at some time to have indigenous militants, Central Asian indigenous militants somewhere near the border, because rather than give the Central Asian governments free hand to support anti-Taliban groups in Afghanistan, they would be better served by letting some of these people go back to Central Asia. They can't defeat the governments militarily or topple them, but what they can do is create a huge amount of instability. And again, historically, what we've seen is when there is chaos and terrorism in Central Asia anywhere, even on a very low scale, the Central Asian governments do not cooperate well with each other. In fact, just the opposite. They're more likely to accuse each other of not cooperating and letting the threat in and not combating it properly. So what we see in Turkmenistan recently, what we've seen along the Tajik-Afghan border for years and years now, these are like probing attacks, but it reminds the militants and the governments on both sides, all sides of the borders there, that this is a threat and it could come back. And, for the Taliban especially, it's useful to see that if the Central Asian governments are going to oppose them and try to aid anti-Taliban forces, they can send their own people in to Central Asia, and the Central Asian governments would have to focus on their own internal security problems rather than looking across the border and trying to figure out how to undo the Taliban influence.
But on the other hand, I mean, what we've seen also, a very interesting reaction by President Karimov. I think he is the only one who is very publicly, harshly opposed to U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. For him, this is coming back to 2001. I mean, in some sense, he believes that this border security will again, he will be threatened again by them from outside. And going back to Turkmen killing, as soon as I heard about it, I mean, the first thing I found, I thought is, if you remember during Taliban time, these guys were easily able to cross the border to get their cars refueled in Turkmenistan. And previous President Niyazov announced the neutrality. He was not engaged in any fighting with Taliban, in comparison to Tashkent or, you know. And now it seems like that Turkmen soldiers in Turkmenistan, this is changing, I mean, pretty much. So in the new post-withdrawal period, I think Turkmenistan will be playing a security role. We'll try to not to allow them into their territory. So, and we'll be more or less joining other forces in Central Asia to stop them, you know, unlike previous President Niyazov. This is just...
Yeah, Alisher, I think the position of Turkmenistan on this subject is to be seen yet. We don't know what's happening in the border and what plans they have in mind after 2014. But we also remember that some of the countries, like especially Uzbekistan, your country, they have exaggerated the threat of the militants or the Taliban threat, and just to find an excuse to crack down.
You can actually blame Karimov of being of anything, dictator, anything, but you cannot blame his ability to predict the threats by the Taliban. You know, even before September 11 attack on United States, President Karimov issued a book that will be a threat to United States. Kind of he had his agents. You know, Uzbek security is very active among IMU, and they kind of have I assume they have good information on the next step. There were even allegations that some of these groups even controlled by Tashkent. Never confirmed, but the allegation is there. So they have a kind of information, and I tend to incline in this case to Karimov that after U.S. withdrawal, the situation will worsen.
If I could just throw something in, and I hope Mr. Malashenko will chime in on this too. I think Uzbekistan's fear right now is partly based on the fact that it is not part of the CSTO anymore and doesn't have very good relations with Russia, whereas Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan all seem to be depending on the fact that Russia and the CSTO will bail them out.
Let's listen to Mr. Dawood from Kabul. I think, you know, is there a reason to believe, Mr. Dawood, that Taliban or people, the militants, let's say, who are currently based in Afghanistan, has any intention to threaten Central Asian countries?
Not yet, because they are still involved inside of Afghanistan. According to my views, and I have a knowledge from the region, you know, still there is Cold War policy there in Pakistan. You know, when former Soviet Union was here in Afghanistan, there was some kind of policy between United States and Pakistan. In that time, they are thinking, when we implement our goal in Afghanistan, we can move to Central Asia, finally we can go to Moscow. And there is this kind of activities also, because since last 13 years, when there is NATO and ISA forces here, I think there is nothing changed inside of Pakistan. In the military side, you know, these Uzbeks, Turkmens, Tajiks, Afghans, Arabs, when they are in tribal area inside of Pakistan, when they are fighting against the Pakistani troops, they must be killed. If these people is going to Afghanistan or somewhere, they can support them. And I think for this kind of, if we looking for peace in the region, after 2014 or 16, which is the mandate of 9,800, President Obama mentioning this, it will be staying there until 2016. I think these parties will be reorganized. And Taliban doesn't have that opportunities because still they are involved in fighting in Afghanistan province by province. How they can support these Central Asia movements. And there is, you know, another reason inside of these countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, in Turkmenistan, they are not human rights. You know, there is no open media activities, democracy. There is also these dictators, and still we are lucky in Afghanistan. There is independent media, there is civil society, there is, you know, these things also supporting this kind of activities and fighting. If there is any change in these countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, and there will be opportunities for the, you know, independent media, civil society, in human rights, and I think there will be change. And otherwise, that's very difficult. I couldn't see that for the next future. I think this country was very lucky when the United States is here in Afghanistan. If they withdraw from Afghanistan in that time, I think there will be a lot of chaos and a lot of problems inside of these countries.
Thank you, Mr. Dawood. It is to be seen yet, you know, what's going to happen after 2014 and what kind of threat that Central Asian or Moscow might be facing from the insiders. Alexei Malashenko, we understand that Moscow is worried about their own indigenous, some radical groups, but what is the plan in Kremlin's mind to tackle the situation in case it deteriorates?
Well, I don't know, but anyway, in a lot of publications, they write about this threat. They have put in prison a lot of people, hundreds of people who came from Central Asia, from Uzbekistan, from Tajikistan. There is another problem. There is a certain exchange between Islamic radical and people from Central Asia and Caucasus. And, of course, between Central Asia and Tatarstan, yes. So I think that the Russian security services, they have some plans. But anyway, indeed, I don't believe that in Kremlin they are able to create a real political, a real course toward Islamic situation. a total Islamic situation, and it transformed in a very, very painful problem. Well, today my colleagues mention a lot Islamic movement of Afghanistan, but for Russia it's not a big deal. For Russia, much more important is Hizb ut-Tahrir al-Islami. And indeed we have a dozen of some groups of Hizb ut-Tahrir in Caucasus, in Dagestan, in Tatarstan, Bashkortostan, and so on. To my mind, this organization is bringing with it to Russia some radical ideas, and of course, first of all, the idea of a caliphate. By the way, Hizb ut-Tahrir, 3 years ago, and even last year, they organized some manifestations in capital of Tatarstan, Kazan. Before it was impossible, before no one could imagine such a situation. And also Hizb ut-Tahrir organized some meetings also in Tatarstan, in Bashkortostan, in order to support Islamic radical opposition in Syria. It is also very important because before, of course, it couldn't take place. So I want to repeat that Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, just even it isn't so often mentioned in Russian publications, in articles, and so on. But as to Hizb ut-Tahrir, well, indeed, it seems that it exists everywhere in Russia.
Mr. Maloshenko, so what can be done about this? I mean, we are just getting out of time that we planned, and I'm afraid that we must conclude our discussion. But what's the fine line for authorities in Central Asia, as well as the international community, to adopt for the future to keep security and stability in the region? Why not to start, Jakub, what's your recipe for that?
I think that is actually the key to limiting the influence of these Central Asian militant groups that may be in Afghanistan, Pakistan, or Syria now, and that have mid- to long-term hopes of returning home and causing instability, because it's all about undermining the militant networks. And currently, the Central Asian governments alone are not able to do that because other governments are likely more knowledgeable about what's happening on the ground in Syria, like the United States or Turkey or Jordan. Similarly, China might be more knowledgeable about what's happening in Pakistan because of its close relationship with Pakistan. And although some of these countries may have rivalries in economics and other issues of politics, when it comes to the militant threat, they all have a shared vision of maintaining the stability in the region, or they, at least they all should. So I think the key for Central Asian governments will be to learn as much as possible about what networks Central Asian militants are making in theaters ranging from Syria to Pakistan, collecting information on them, and then breaking up these networks if they try to return home, or at least establishing some form of rehabilitation mechanism for those who have gone to Syria or Pakistan and want to come home and reintegrate into society. Because from my research in Kyrgyzstan, a number of Kyrgyz have went to Syria and realized that this is Muslims fighting against Muslims, that everyone is pretty much bad in this equation, that Shias are still people, that Shias are still Muslims. And there are a lot of people that are actually disoriented by the jihadist movement and can become allies in the counter-jihadist movement when they return home. So it's part of a mix of intelligence sharing and sound policies on the home front.
Noah Toker, what's your take on that?
Well, I have to say I agree with Jacob about that as people return home, I don't think we should treat them all the same for the few who maybe are going to survive the conflict in Syria and try to come back. There may be some who come back to try to start cells with some of these organizations that they've been in contact with there, like the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant or Jabhat al-Nusra. But then there are probably going to be many other people who come home just because they don't feel personally involved in that war. And I think it's important not to treat them all with a broad brush. And in the same way, I think it's important to distinguish between groups. I guess I would differ a little bit with Alexei. It's important to distinguish between groups that advocate violence and groups that advocate politics. I think the broader the brush you use to paint and the bigger the hammer you use to hit even Islamist activists, the fewer options they have to do anything other than leave the country, or the more attractive you make governments who, the more attractive you make groups that are willing to overthrow the government. I think we need to make a clear distinction between groups that advocate violence and groups that don't.
Right, thank you. I just want to give microphone to my colleague Ali Sheer here, just to get his point.
Yeah, final note, just wanted to say, you know, what we're seeing, the conflict in Afghanistan where Uzbeks were kind of fighting, then the new conflict is in Syria, and there is a kind of a amateur belief that these guys are going there and they'll be killed there, so, and then we will be living in peace. But unfortunately, as much of these fightings we see, they never getting vanished. I mean, on the contrary, the number is being increased all the time. So some countries, I mean, especially in Uzbekistan, they believe that they're going and they sort of cleaning our country from these radicals. But on the other hand, I believe that these conflicts are radicalizing further and increasing the number of people ready to join and to fight in these conflicts. And then it has, of course, the precautions for all the Central Asian states.
Bruce, briefly, your final note on this. I mean, what should be done to deal with that?
You know, I mean, everything depends on what kind of moves they make in the next few months. There's no doubt about it. There's certainly a strong dislike of the government in Central Asia on the part of a lot of people that live there or have been chased out of the place. In a lot of ways, the ball is really in the court of the Central Asian governments to show that their state and their idea, their ideology is more viable than the ones that the militants are offering to try to attract people into their camps. You know, I mean, we've tried the military thing. They've tried the security crackdowns. It's ended up doing more harm than good. And they're really going to have to come up with a big plan, some grand strategy that's going to, in an ideological way, defeat the very threat that is facing them in the coming months. And that, sadly, that might be asking a lot from the Central Asian governments because it requires a lot of rethinking and a lot of change.
Mr. Daoud, what Afghanistan can do to help Central Asian countries to deal with the groups that might pose threat in post-2014?
We are going to go to a second round of election. If we selected the new president, and I think this new president will be providing peace plan for the region, including Afghanistan. In that time, you know, if we have a active president and he gets support from the public and he has a common peace languages with the neighbors in international society, including the United States, in this regard, maybe Afghanistan will be starting first with Afghan opposition parties like Taliban, they can start a peace process. And I think if this peace process gave us some positive result here in Afghanistan, definitely that will be affected peace, stability, security in the region. Without that, I think that's very difficult. If there is regional conference, because there is a lot of problem right now, like all our colleagues, they are following situation between the United States, Russia and Europe. I think the only option, as far as we Afghans thinking on it, that will be Afghan peace process. If we have a peace with our political parties like Taliban, and I think that will be good door for the peace instead of Central Asia countries.
We must really end here our discussion. And thank you very much, my colleagues here, Ali Sher Siddiqov, Bruce Panier, and Jakub Sen from China, Noah Toker from Washington, D.C., Haji Said Daoud from Kabul, and Alexei Maleshenko from Moscow. Thank you very much for sparing your
time
for this discussion. It was a pleasure to have you on board.